everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. You know, most of us have some sexual wounds. And the consequences of having one's sexual boundaries violated can range from annoying to seriously traumatic. And for this program, we have one of the best sexual experts. Considered a consultation with Dr. Stephanie Buehler, who was last here August the 19th when we discussed sexual pain, another really difficult issue. So glad you're back, Dr. Stephanie. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about what is definitely a tough topic for a lot of people.
It's a tough topic. I mean, we're addressing sexual abuse, and this is really the first time that I've had a whole program for this subject, but it needs to be discussed. It really does, because you have many clients with issues around this, and I do too, and have in the past. And so when a girl or a woman may feel pleasure, but it's where there's been traumatic sex, it's mixed with other feelings such as disgust, anger, fear, and confusion. So it makes it all very complicated.
It is very complicated, and yes, definitely. And, you know, a lot of people, when they have those kinds of issues, they don't know what to do, so they just step things down. And sometimes it isn't until much later in life that they realize that they've been affected by some kind of molestation that happened early on.
Yes, and so let's tell our listeners some of the ways that sexual abuse affects adults.
Well,
because there's a whole range of things.
There's a whole host of things. Some are more sexual in nature and some are not.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that are not are, you know, not feeling safe, being hypervigilant, kind of always watchful of where one is, holding back in situations because you're not sure of your own boundaries, and you don't trust other people as much as maybe you might if this had never happened to you. It can also lead to severe problems. Like you said, it can lead to, for example, alcohol abuse or drug abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes sexual withdrawal and sometimes sexual acting out. And, a lot of people don't connect either of those behaviors with things that happened to them when they were young. The sexual things can happen to either men or women, and they don't necessarily occur until, like I said, later in life, maybe after the birth of a child or when a child gets to be the age that the person was when they were initially harmed. And those things can be, for both men and women, a loss of interest in sex. For women, difficulty having orgasm. Sometimes, but rarely, sexual pain. And sometimes sexual aversion, which is sort of like a sexual phobia, being afraid of engaging in sexual behavior. I have also had men in my office who have been molested, who have erectile dysfunction or delayed ejaculation. And all of these things are embarrassing. And so people sometimes don't seek out help or don't know that there is help.
That there is help.
Yes, that there is help, and they can be sexually healthy, whole, happy people.
Sometimes a man who's been molested, often, because many times the perpetrator is another man, maybe a soccer coach or whatever, so he also has shame, and He may wonder about his own sexuality. And did he bring this on himself? And, of course, we have to separate that out for our clients. Can you expand on that a bit, Dr. Stephanie?
Yes. Oh, yes. That can be very confusing for a young boy, you know, whose body responded automatically, perhaps with, you know, perhaps with an erection or, you know, even ejaculation, you know, just doing what it does naturally. And so boys and teenagers sometimes wonder, does that mean I'm gay? Is that what that was about? And I've had men actually experiment trying to figure it out and getting more confused, you know, or men who shy away from having any sexual contact with anyone because they don't understand what happened to them.
Right.
And, yeah. Yeah. Very sad.
So one of our jobs as the clinician, as a therapist, is to really help them understand that man or woman, back when they were perhaps a girl or a boy, that as victims, they're not responsible, and that they're hardwired for sexual responsiveness. And sometimes this can just be so illuminating and useful for the client to understand that, they're not responsible for the abuse. They might have some strange ideas about how they might have brought it on, but it's just not true.
No, it isn't true. I just had a fellow therapist, when I explained that, like young women may have vaginal lubrication before say a date rape occurs, and you know that it's brought to their attention. Well, that's proof that you wanted this to happen.
Yeah,
and really, it's just the body protecting itself from injury.
Exactly.
You know, right. And you know, so there's a lot of shame with those kinds of responses. I must want to be sexually engaged in this way with this person for my body to react that way. And, you know, it can be frightening, I think. You know, it makes a person really want to keep all of that quiet. And sometimes people hold on to these injuries for decades before they open up and talk to somebody.
And in my experience, it almost always needs professional intervention by a therapist who really knows what he or she is doing in terms of the training is involved.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember seeing a woman who had pretty severe sexual abuse, and she said, it was pretty good insight, really. She said, I learned how to set boundaries, finally, but I set too many. And as soon as I learned to say no, then I couldn't say yes again. So she had sexual aversion and lack of orgasm, because orgasm is about letting go and surrendering, and so often that's blocked.
Yes, absolutely. The shame, again, it's like a lot of shame, you know, shame to show pleasure during any kind of sexual encounter. And that's amazing that she had that insight, that she realized once she learned that she could say no, she said no to everything.
Exactly.
And, yeah, that definitely happens.
Yeah, and then couldn't say yes. Yes. So, it's usually kids and young teens who are the most often molested, and how do they find out they have sexual problems as a result of the abuse? Because, as you said to me off the air, they may function well enough, but sometimes they're under a lot of stress or something happens to remind them of the abuse, and then they struggle. It's almost like PTSD, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. So, you know, some people know before they are ever engaged in a relationship that something is off sexually. You know, they know, they hear how their friends talk about having sexual experiences, and they know that doesn't fit. Like, they have a lot of fears about it, or sometimes too much interest, you know, much more interest than their friends do. So that's a cue. But sometimes it's when, you know, what we know as therapists is that when people go through developmental milestones, that is, you know, leaving home, getting married, having a child, getting a job, all of those things that are positive, they also cause stress. And, you know, we need all of our inner resources to get through those developmental milestones. And so sometimes a person doesn't have enough inner resources to manage both those developmental milestones and all the stuff they've been trying to clamp down on and suppressed. And so many times when people come into my office, it's after the birth of a child or, you know, after having a vacation with their partner for an anniversary, like a 10-year anniversary, and they come back and they go like, I don't know what's wrong with me, but when my partner would touch me, I would just feel sick to my stomach or, you know, just feel creepy or something like that. And I never felt like that before, but it's something's triggered this, and I don't know what to do about it. So, you know, we go through, I think the treatment a lot of times is trying to sort out what happened, but more so trying to educate the client about why they are having the reactions that they are having, you know, and you know, so, you know, sometimes it's very subtle what has happened. You know, the partner has, I had one woman whose partner, when he brushed her upper thigh, she would just kind of go through the roof. She didn't understand it at all until in therapy she said, oh my gosh, I just remembered that, you know, my uncle would try to put his hand between my thighs, and so his hand would brush across my thigh, and that's exactly where my husband is brushing his hand, and I just, oh, I don't know what to do about that. It just makes me crazy. And
so these are body memories, and the body does have memories, and for a number of years, I co-led with Dr. Maria Flaherty two women's sexuality groups where all of the women had experienced sexual trauma. And we worked with a body therapist. I mean, not at the same time, but some of these women would go to her and have body work. And so sometimes a memory would be evoked when the therapist touched her in a certain way. It's pretty amazing the memories that bodies hold, and and then the other thing we found is that if the perpetrator, for instance, had a beard, the husband of the victim and our group person had a beard, we'd often suggest that he'd shave the beard. So that some of these similar memories would not be evoked.
Right. Yeah, so that's a really good point, that if a person can identify, and I'm thinking that you probably use this word also, but triggers, they identify what their triggers are, then they can make changes either with how they handle what's coming up or making changes in the environment. So they realize, oh my gosh, you know what? The sheets on my bed are creeping me out, and I don't understand. Oh wait, these are the color sheets that I had on my bed when my, you know, relative came in and, you know, bothered me. So you know, making very concrete changes sometimes is a really great thing, and I think it's, you know, empowering to take control over one's environment and one's reactions to things, and you know, can be a very, very positive experience to recognize, what is actually happening instead of being in a state of turmoil or state of confusion all the time.
Exactly. And, the Freudian concept of repetition compulsion may figure in here, too. And especially when we talk about a child who reaches the age they were when the abuse started. And, I understand, especially among male victims, and sometimes the victim then becomes a perpetrator later, molesting, a boy who's also 8. And the idea unconsciously would be that the perpetrator would want the child to have a better experience than they did. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
it's usually very unconscious.
Very sad situation.
Yes.
Very sad. And, that, of course, that can lead into really awful consequences for someone who's, repeating things in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I've had women do admit to that kind of thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Being maybe babysitting or doing childcare and realizing that, it didn't work out very well for them because they had these very strange urges, that they had to struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
And, those things, some people come to a place of realizing, I don't think I'm comfortable to be around children because I do struggle, and others are able to overcome that and understand it and be perfectly fine, and they have their own children, raise their own children with no problem. But that's something that never gets talked about openly, really, that good people sometimes struggle mightily with strange urges if they've been molested.
Yes, all of these urges rooted in their past. And our unconscious is complicated and sometimes tricky, but
definitely.
So occasionally I've seen women who actually have managed to emerge from sexual abuse empowered. They have more self efficacy because they were able to transform feelings of victimization into kind of an empowered confidence and a sense that I can take care of myself. And I had this experience when I was in my early 20s and I was working in Italy for the summer. It was a glorious part-time job as a teacher. And was in this little town called Torvianica, which is right on the water, and it's near Ostia. And one day, on my day off, I went into Rome and came back on the train to Ostia, but there were no longer buses running from Ostia to Torvianica, which is this little beautiful town. And so I had traveled a good amount alone in my life, including around the world when I was only 24 for 9 months. So I had a good amount of confidence and intuition. But I overrode that because there I was stuck at this bus station. How did I get to Torvianica? So this Italian guy in a convertible pulled up and asked me if I wanted a ride. So against my better judgment, I said yes. Well, on the way back to Torvianica, he took a detour, pulled into a sand dune, and lunged at me and clearly wanted to rape me or sexually assault me.
Oh, my God.
And it was frightening, but somehow I pulled myself together and said in Italian, which was a brand new language for me, I was still learning it, that this was a mistake, that I had a boyfriend, that I was an American, and that he would give Italians a bad name if he assaulted me.
That was smart.
I know. I don't know how I came up with the words, but my adrenaline in Italian, but my adrenaline was running high. It worked. He came away from me and zipped up his pants and kind of grumbled, but drove me the rest of the way home in safety. So that gave me a great sense of empowerment that I could handle things.
Yeah, right. So that's something, that's a quite an incredible story that you were able to somehow to keep your wits about you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it sounds like you learned, hey, you know what, I can, you know, speak up for myself if I'm in danger. Now, sometimes, you know, people speak up when they're in danger. It doesn't make
I know. It doesn't. It doesn't. And I was also lucky. But backing up a little bit, I made a mistake. I should have trusted my intuition, which is good, and not accepted the ride with a stranger.
Right, of course.
Yeah. But then again, a lot of women who are sexually assaulted, now we're moving away from relative abuse, you know, a stepfather or an uncle or whatever, to rape, sexual assault, and they'll go over and over, oh, well, I shouldn't have done this, I shouldn't have done that, and part of the therapy becomes, no, you were still a victim, and yes, so there are lots of things you shouldn't have done, but still, this man took advantage of you.
Right, and nobody should take advantage of anyone. I remember I had a young woman in my office, and this was a situation where she had recently had a baby, and even though she was doing fine, there was no, you know, like postpartum depression, anything mm-hmm. like that, she was just having a really hard time getting back into the swing of a sex life with her husband, and she realized, I think, it's because I was a sitter for an infant. Mm. And during that time, and she was really young, I mean, she was under 16,
mm-hmm.
During that time, the father of the infant I was sitting for acted as if he were my boyfriend.
Mm.
And, you know, he'd drive me home, and he would say wonderful things to me, and, you know, it ended up being sexual, and I just feel so guilty.
Mm-hmm.
I said, why do you feel guilty? How, you know, you were young, and you know, impressionable and maybe even flattered that somebody
mm-hmm.
older and handsome was curious about you or interested in you. And she said, well, that's true. I mean, he was very attractive. And I said, well, you know what? It wouldn't matter, though. If he was a decent person, you could have come on to him and he would have said, now, what are you doing? You know,
mm-hmm.
this is not right. You know,
mm-hmm.
and we can't be like this. And you know, I can be in trouble, and you won't like what happens, and, you know, this is not for us, so we're not going to do this. I'm an adult, and you aren't. So, you know, that's that. And when she heard that, she went like, oh, my God, I never thought about it that way. I never realized, you know, that
you helped her separate it out.
You know, yeah, she really had to, like, really hear that from somebody that, you know, it wouldn't matter if she danced around naked. You know, the onus, the responsibility is with the adult. You know, that to take care of a child, that's what adults are supposed to do. All adults know that, not a secret. And for an adult to hurt a child in that way is really, it's really a heinous thing to do. Yeah, and who knows what he said to her. To make her feel like it was partly her idea, and, you know.
And she's vulnerable and young and innocent.
Yeah.
And, I find when I work with these women who've had this sort of sexual trauma, it's good to develop kind of a perspective, and this often takes a good amount of therapy. And the perspective is, that's what I experienced. That's how it is. Because then that allows them to move on. But when sexual boundaries are violated, and I'd really like your response to this, there are some conditions that can help make the outcome less traumatic. So a girl or a woman, if she is able to tell someone about what happened immediately after the abuse takes place, yes, if she is believed, and if the person she tells is supportive and affirms that she did not cause the abuse, that it was the person who violated her who was responsible and wrong. So those things will help. Telling right away, if she's believed, and if the person supports her. And hasn't, perhaps you would expand on that or is confirm it?
Yeah, right, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. You know, all of those things are extremely helpful. Mm-hmm. The things that are harmful are when a child goes to a parent or a caregiver and tells what happened and they're not believed.
Mm-hmm.
That's extremely confusing and sometimes makes the child very angry. And sometimes one parent will defend the other. If there was a parent or a step-parent who molested, they may actually jump to that person's defense. And that's a very terrible outcome when a child speaks up. That kind of violation of trust needs to be addressed in therapy. Very hard to have an appropriate amount of trust in a partner when this has happened to you. And that's what I think so many people who have been molested really struggle with is
mm-hmm.
to, like you said, how to lose control, how to give over trust, how to, be sexual and close and intimate with somebody when this has happened to you.
Yes, and even with the women sexuality groups that I co-led so many years ago, all of these women, pretty much all of them, had trouble with orgasm. But orgasm is about letting go, surrendering, and when your boundaries have been violated through sexual trauma, that's very difficult to do. So sometimes it may take a year or more and even trusting the partner more and some work with the partner. And we're going to get into that in the second half of the program, because what about the partner?
Yeah.
And we also want to talk about what type of treatment is available. We've already touched on that a little bit, but I want to make this more specific because this program is really about providing resources and help for people. And it's good to know that this program, since it's internet-based, is heard in lots of countries where the sex education is pretty much non-existent.
Mm.
I get some feedback from people in India and in Turkey, just to give two examples, where they're grateful that they can download this program and listen to it. And the media is a wonderful way to get out good, solid information, Stephanie, and I'm so glad you're my guest because you have so much information and you're so experienced and so wise and the author of many books. We'll come back to that after the break. So we're going to talk about after the break what type of sexual treatment or treatment is available and what about the partner and some other things too. So stay with us and we'll be right back. And we're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and once again, Dr. Stephanie Buehler is my guest. She is the director of the Buehler Institute, and this is in Southern California. She is an internationally recognized expert in sex and relationship therapy, and she knows a lot. And Stephanie, I'm so glad you're with me today on this program, this evening on this program. So what types of treatment are available when somebody has had sexual trauma, sexual abuse. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. So there are a few different directions that people go in, but I think most people end up in the office of a talk therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they go to someone who specializes in trauma, which is that's good. However, trauma therapists are not always aware of, nor are they trained in helping people who are sexually abused to overcome sexual difficulties. I think if you were to poll a lot of trauma therapists about what the sexual late effects are of sexual abuse, that many of them wouldn't be able to really speak about it. So it's fine with me. I'm thinking it's fine with a lot of sex therapists for someone to see a good trauma therapist first and then come into sex therapy to work on the sexual piece. But I have to say that a lot of people could come directly into sex therapy because our sexuality affects so much of who we are. And of course, you know, the idea is that abuse is not sexual in nature. However, it is about power, it is about pleasure, it is about control and loss of control, it's about boundaries, it's about trust, it's about intimacy, and all of these issues that sex therapists are very good at talking about and treating when there are problems. So I vote for sex therapists. When there are sexual problems as a result of trauma, you know, just go to that type of expert first if possible. I think you can save a lot of time and energy, really, by directly addressing what's going on in the bedroom, you know, between the sheets, between your ears, between you mm-hmm. and your partner.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you talk about teaching mindfulness, which certainly helps during sex as well as other times. And mindfulness, could you expand on that?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. So mindfulness is it's a very old form of meditation that has had renewed interest because it helps with so many things. And when it comes to helping someone who's been sexually abused, mindfulness and mindful meditation help somebody to stay grounded in the present moment and be able to experience what's going on now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to release themselves from the past. The way I read about and learned about mindfulness is, you know, the past is there for you to learn something from.
Mm-hmm.
If you've already learned about, gotten the lesson, it's okay to move on. Or if you look back and you go like, you know what, there's no lesson there really for me. So, mindfulness just keeps you in the present moment. Again, different approaches. The easiest is to, I think... I was just saying to somebody the other day that Americans have this way of taking a very simple concept like mindfulness, blowing it up into something big, packaging it and selling it and making it seem like it's something really grand. Really, it's a very simple practice.
Mm-hmm.
Just maybe, sitting in a chair is one way. You just sit in a chair, you keep your eyes open or closed. Just pay attention to the breath. You don't have to do anything fancy with your breath. You just pay attention to it. You can have a little saying as you breathe. Breathe in, I breathe in happiness. Breathe out, I breathe out contentment. Or, just something like that, just to keep you kind of grounded. And then when you have thoughts, you just let them go by. You let them go by like a cloud or, like a breeze through an open window or... just dissolve like vapor and, not pay too much attention to them. And we don't really understand what thoughts are anyway.
Mm-hmm,
I heard a neurosurgeon say, when I opened up the brain, I realized I've never seen a thought. I don't know. What
That's very good.
You know, I mean, they're just creations. They're very, you know, and some thoughts are worth having, and some thoughts are just like, who knows why that thought came up. So, you know, you can just, when you have a thought, you can just say, well, that's interesting. That's interesting. I'm just going to let that one go by, and here comes another one. After you've practiced for a while, you realize that most of your thoughts really aren't that substantial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just get into a much more comfortable place where you're not judging things. You don't have so much fear about the future. And you're just able to stay in the present moment. And that's very good when you're having a sexual relationship with somebody, because, you know, being sexual requires you to be present and to experience what's going on in that moment. So I know with my clients, when I teach them mindfulness, I'll say to them, you know, get yourself very grounded. Really take a look around the room and notice details, you know, the color of the walls, the light in the room, the feeling of the bed underneath your body, and tell yourself, hey, you know what, I'm here now. You know, this is what's going on right now. And the partner that I'm with is someone of my choosing, and we are going to have this experience now. And the experience I have now will be different than experiences than I've had in the past. And that approach really seems to help most people. Not everyone, I have to admit, not everyone gets it. But those who, you know, who this works for, it's very effective way to get out of the grips of the past and be able to just enjoy what's going on today.
Exactly. And this helps women with low desire and women who are having trouble with orgasms to just be very present, not multitask, surrender to the moment, let go, but it's very, very hard for lots of people, for lots of women in particular. And but this mindfulness, I'm here now, I like the way you say that. It's very useful.
I've had, you know, people who have been sexually abused and those who have not. Men, too, you know, being present, they're having problems with erections or delayed ejaculation or early or premature ejaculation. Mm-hmm. And just really paying attention to one's body, not thinking, you know, what do you need thoughts for while you're having sex? You really don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they sort of don't belong, right? Except thoughts like, oh, this is nice.
Yeah.
That feels good.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And also being present, I think, requires having some appreciation for sensuality apart from sexuality.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah,
that it's understanding sensuality is a crucial ingredient of problem-free lovemaking, because say a victim may want to engage in sensual love play, particularly massage, as a therapeutic tension release long before she feels ready to resume lovemaking. And for some men, it can be difficult to stop at the sensual without becoming sexual. So then that becomes a point of discussion
in
the
therapy. Right. You know. So, you know, some sex therapists will say to a couple, you know, your sex life really isn't working. I mean, it's creating bad feelings, conflict, triggers are happening. You know, can you maybe just put sex, meaning intercourse, on hold for a bit, and you know, you can come back to it. It's not gone forever, but just put it on hold and let's see if you can have some more positive experiences and, you know, kind of lay a new foundation. And like you said, like engaging in sensual experiences, like, you know, sensual touching experiences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it can be very small. I mean, it can just be, you know, a hand massage. You know, let's start there. You know, just
hand, feet, yeah. Both hands and feet have lots of nerve endings, so that often works.
Yes, right.
And it's just, as you say, the focus is on developing healthy control and on enjoyment of touch. Touch for the sake of touch, right?
Right. Touch that isn't exploitive.
Uh-huh.
You know, or it's just happening because it's fun, it's pleasurable, it's enjoyable, not because your partner wants something from you that you don't want to give them.
You've just said something very important, because so many victims of sexual abuse have this notion long embedded in their psyche that they were exploited, that a man wanted something. It's usually a man. Sometimes it's a woman, but not very often. A man wanted something from them and took it from them. They were, in fact, exploited.
Yes. Yes. And so that leads to some very difficult patterns in people's relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes women will act as if their partner is a perpetrator. And,
yeah.
You know, when you bring this up, the partner goes like, yes, that's exactly right. I just want to make love.
Mm-hmm.
My partner thinks that I'm trying to get something from them.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't understand that, you know, I want this to be fun. I want this to be good for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
That when I approach it, I get rejected. And it's very, you know, it's a very painful rejection, because
mm-hmm.
all I have is love for my partner, and I'm getting shot down. Or even sometimes accused of things, you know, because the poor person who's been abused is sometimes very confused, has a very difficult time sorting out what was going on. It's like, you know, the past has a hold on them. They have a hard time escaping from what happened to them in the past and trusting their partner. And it's a very painful situation for both of them. They really have to be able to understand why this is happening and know that good communication, I would say sufficient therapy. It's going to take more than 3 sessions to address this type of problem. It just is, you know, and to be committed to working things through. The couples that do that often end up with a good sex life.
Yes.
Because they've had to talk about everything, you know, kind of get through.
Right. And they've gotten through it. I often will counsel the partner of a woman, like, who's been sexually assaulted, raped, or anything, or if the sexual molestation from her past comes out, I'll say, listen, and then listen some more. There is a natural tendency when confronting the victim of any personal tragedy to try to turn attention away from the terrible event, so that the partner might say, you know, very well-meaning, it's over now, try to put it behind you, you've got your whole life in front of you, don't dwell on it. So it's not very helpful, because we know from lots of research and from experience that encouraging trauma victims to relive their tragedies is central to crisis intervention and to healing.
Right. Yes. But they have to, you and I talked about this a little bit, they have to, you know, things have to be paced.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
paced, yeah.
So, yeah. To, you know, just look at a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes looking at the whole thing all at once, especially if there's sometimes there have been multiple abusers, or, you know, it's gone on for a couple of years. You know, not to look at all of that all at once, to just look at a little bit, a little piece of it, and understand it, and put it in perspective, and get a sense of, like, okay, that's what happened to me. I understand what was going on now with my body, with my mind, with my emotions, you know, why I told, why I didn't tell, all of those things. And as you go through those little bits, you build the confidence to keep going until, you know, you've kind of integrated that experience, meaning, yes, this happened to me. I don't like that it happened to me, but I can live with it, and I don't have to let it rule my life anymore. Ah, what a moment that is.
Yes. So, yes. And, yeah, I don't have, then there's that freedom, that liberating feeling. But along the way, there are these speed bumps, like guys who say, you know, she's been abused, she's been beaten and raped, and all I care about is getting laid, so there's a lot of guilt around that. Yep. And most lovers of sexually assaulted women have, they really do have deep feelings of outrage and shame and guilt, and they got to work these out. So the partner does need to be paid attention to. And I say to these men, let yourself get help in dealing with your own reactions to the assault, to the sexual abuse. Because men who take care of their own emotional needs tend to provide better support to their lovers.
Oh, my gosh, what a good point.
So true.
And instead of being stoic, sometimes they want to be stoic.
Right. Because men are kind of raised to be stoic.
Yes, right.
Often.
Right. And, you know, not admit how hurt they are or how angry they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it spills over, like you said, in a lack of support, that they, you know, you give them instructions or recommendations of things to do or not to do, and they don't follow them. And you're like, what is going on here? You know, they're not really completely on board. I don't get angry at them, a little maybe, but, you know, it's like, you know, you really need to go and talk to someone yourself and, you know, get support for you, because it's not easy to support someone who has been sexually abused.
Not easy at all.
These are some of the toughest cases. I know in my practice, they're some of the toughest cases that I will treat. And they usually are long-term.
Right.
And, you know, but they can be the most gratifying as well.
Well, because there, you just mentioned it, when there's the breakthrough. Oh, wow, I'm finally free to experience my sexuality with my lover. And I can now have orgasms. That's definitive, isn't it? When a woman can let go to have orgasms.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Yeah, tough cases, but aren't we fortunate, Dr. Stephanie, that we get to do this work where we can make a difference? I just, I count my blessings every day about it. You know, to make a difference in people's lives. And we both have had lots of training, and that makes a difference so that we can help people better.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that leads me to maybe a final area of exploration before the show ends. Do all therapists who treat adults molested as children treat sexual problems? So you have, I know, some good answers to that.
Unfortunately, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many, and it's not, you know, you can't really blame the therapist, because for a multiple number of reasons, therapists do not always receive training in their graduate school programs I even had a therapist tell me in another part of the country, we're on the West Coast, but someone in the Midwest say that they were specifically told that they were not going to, that they should not treat sexual problems because they were more likely to be reported to their licensing board.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Yes, yes, I know. Oh, my gosh. When I heard that, I...
Well, only if the therapist has sex with the clients, which is very rare, and of course, you could lose your license, but the vast majority of therapists wouldn't even consider that.
Right, of course not. And so, you know, just the idea that just talking about sex could result in that kind of,
Was this somewhere in the Bible, Bill, perhaps?
My mind. As a matter of fact, yes.
Yes.
Yes, it was. Yes.
You know, I have to tell you a story. Many years ago, somewhere around 1997, I had just done, for the Sinclair Institute, I had narrated A Couple's Guide to Great Sex Over 40. And the Sinclair Institute got me on, I don't know, Radio America, I think it was called. When it came time for me to be on a radio show in the Bible Belt, I was not allowed on because the idea was that sex is for procreation, not recreation. So, you know, sex over 40, you know, probably not. So they didn't want me.
Why would you have sex?
Why would you have sex over 40 if you can't conceive a baby? We sex therapists who have healthy relationships know how much joy sexuality and a sexual relationship can bring. How much joy. And I think of it for myself as an aging woman that it's like a fountain of youth to be able to be sexual and to have orgasms and all of that. It's just great.
Right. And to be able to be close to someone in that way. And
yes.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So, you know, and I think I agree with you to be able to do this work and to help people enjoy an essential part of life. I mean, sex is one of the things that gives you a good quality of life. And when that doesn't work, can make your whole life miserable. So, you know, getting help and, don't be embarrassed to talk to a sex therapist because they've basically heard it all.
Absolutely. We have heard it all. And, I just had a new couple yesterday, an older couple, and she said, I'm nervous and afraid. And I said, well, thank you for being so clear about that and I said something like that, I've heard it all, and I want to make you as comfortable as you can be. And she visibly relaxed as this session went on. It was very nice to see. Because people are very vulnerable around their sexuality. And so we sometimes have to be very sensitive and extra tender.
Yes. Definitely.
So, Dr. Stephanie, as we wind up this show, I would just like to say that, well, thank you to you, but to kind of encapsulate a lot of what we've talked about on this program, that it's important to seek help as soon as possible so that potential opportunities for pleasure and intimacy can be fulfilled.
Ooh, that's very well said.
Thank you. So, it ties into what you just said. So we have quality of life. Mm-hmm. And when we have quality of life, including passion and sexuality, which is the motivating part of love, there's the commitment side, which is the cognitive part, thinking of a triangle, the intimacy side, the emotional part, but that the base of the triangle is passion, the motivating part. Sternberg's idea from years ago, he was at Yale, Dr. Stephanie, you've agreed to come back. I'm delighted. Thank you so much for another really informative and fascinating show. And we need to talk more about these difficult topics. So thank you.
I agree. And thank you for having me on.
Well, you're welcome. And you'll be back. And I'm about to write up today's description, and people will know how to reach you if they have more questions.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.